Hey, welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us, Brandon. We got lots to talk about, man. A lot of politicking in the air. We got midterm elections. But before we get to that news, we've got a lot going on just nationally and here in Texas. Sandra Day O'Connor, former Justice of the Supreme Court, recently announced that she was diagnosed with dementia and is pulling herself out of sort of public life. Really significant historical figure, first woman on the United States Supreme Court. What will be her sort of long legacy, you think?
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been getting a lot of attention lately. She's become kind of a cult favorite, right, for the movie that came out, the notorious RBG, which is fantastic, I think, generally. But it was Justice O'Connor, as you say, who was the first woman on the court and was, frankly, the glue for a lot of cases in the 80s and 90s, right, that still shaped the jurisprudence of the court. So things like abortion, things like affirmative action, she was the one who really kind of kept the coalition together and was the sort of swing vote that provided that moderation. So that was really where the court, I think, sort of solidified many of the big issues that they have dealt with. Now, we'll have a new court, so we'll see what her legacy is, but at least for the time period she was on the court, it was clear that she was really that sort of centrist swing vote in a way that really did sort of direct the court into that moderation that we see on these issues.
Yeah, I think her legacy is a little bit confusing in many ways because she was never the darling of both conservatives or liberals. She truly was this centrist justice. And as a consequence, she's not this beloved figure by anyone.
Yeah.
And many conservatives, I think, assumed incorrectly that she would be sort of pivotal in overturning Roe v. Wade. She did not do that, but essentially sort of refocused it. And I think as a result, she in many ways was criticized heavily by sort of the structural right, the Federalist Society folks and folks like that. And as you said, you made the comparison with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who has a following in the left because she has been sort of the lion of the left, mm-hmm. as sort of the modern-day William O. Douglas. Sandra Day O'Connor never had that, and so her place in our history is massive, but politically it's always been going to be kind of murky for her.
Yeah, she may be the last person to serve in the court who had legislative experience, and that's something that does provide for a recipe for that compromise, and you don't see that as much. So we'll see what that.
And interesting like other forward. Fun fact, she's the only person on the court in the last several years that's not from the East Coast. She's also the only other person who did not go to law school at Harvard or Yale.
Interesting, yeah.
She went to Stanford, which is hardly like slumming it, but
jeez, why bother, right?
Yeah.
You know, she also dated William Rehnquist, the Chief Justice.
That is right.
Isn't that weird?
She did.
Small world, right?
Yes, very small world. Well, shifting gears a bit, and this is a much more serious and terrible story, and we've talked about this sort of the coarseness in our political structure now and the potential ramifications of what this charge language can be. Well, just in the last 48 hours, just as a reminder, we do tape this on Thursday mornings. There's been a rash of bomb scares for leading Democratic politicians across the country. There's a lot of tension surrounding this, and there's been a lot of accusations that the language surrounding and coming out of our electoral process, our political process, is contributing to sort of this type of action, this crazy action.
Yeah, it's maybe not surprising, but it's certainly saddening to see that this has come to this. We don't exactly know what the intention of the person who sent these packages is. It's clearly the fact that they're deranged in some way. Now, the White House and Republicans have condemned this, and the president has sort of suggested that he thinks that this is not appropriate and has decried the political violence. But of course, on the other side, the Democrats are saying that your words are hollow because you've done specific things which have encouraged these kinds of violent actions. So there's definitely, I think, a kind of friction at this, and it's going to be, I think, a lot of back and forth. The Democrats have been accused of essentially inciting much of this themselves, right? Senator Cruz actually suggested that perhaps it's the fact that the Democrats are to blame for this, but it's impossible to know, I think, because this could be the work of just one deranged person. But it certainly is a political argument that Cruz and others want to make that the Democrats are sort of activated and are really using this as a kind of inciting moment. It sort of takes the filling out of that taco because it looks like this is enough. It's coming from both sides, coming from everywhere. So this is certainly the case that I think politically that it doesn't need to be an issue. It needs to be solved, and this needs to be ratcheted down.
For me, I think the interesting element of it has been that what you're seeing is sort of the larger political climate as a whole has just been so confrontational on both sides. Yes, you're certainly having Democrats engaging in sort of aggressive acts of civil disobedience. And I'm not talking about the marching. I'm talking about, you know, doing really sort of inappropriate things like stopping people from being able to eat their meal at a restaurant. Mm-hmm. But that pales in comparison to mailing explosive devices to elected officials. So so I get that part of it. But I just think I'm not sure how long we can sustain a situation where the president of the United States sort of throws kind of verbal, pardon the expression, verbal bombs all the time. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what you've had, whether it's related to the press, whether it's related to particular individuals.
Yeah.
Now he's dialed it down dramatically, just in the last 48 hours about at sort of Trump style rallies that he's been having, but I'm not sure he can sustain that.
Right, I think that's right, and I think it's lamentable that we're here, but it predates Trump, right? The politics of this sort have been bubbling for at least a decade, so it's at the culmination point, and maybe we can pull back, or maybe not. Hey, speaking of Trump, there have been some interesting new rules that they've put forth to alter the definition of what it means to have a gender. So what's going on?
Well, what the Trump administration has essentially tried to do is effectively kind of wipe out the concept of transgender people.
Yeah.
Deeply troubling because essentially what he's saying is that you are what you are, male or female. That's a permanent thing. It would apply to Title IX. It would essentially prevent transgender people from competing at intercollegiate sports levels and dealing with sort of getting civil protections along those lines.
Yes.
So it's hugely problematic. It essentially, we've talked about this before, strips away Obama-era reforms and regulations that were put in place. What makes it more troubling is the way the Trump administration's approached it. It essentially permanently codifies it as opposed to placing it in sort of an executive order system, which is what Obama had done.
Yeah. This is an interesting ramification to the victory for Donald Trump, right? We talk about elections a lot. We're going to talk a lot about what this midterm will mean, but this is really where a lot of the power in government is. That's the administrative state. So a small rule change here in terms of what defines gender is going to have a big impact on a lot of people. So this is something that is worth watching given that it's small in scope and people don't usually pay attention to it, right? It's going to be swamped by all the election news and all of the changes that we're going to see. But this is the kind of thing that has a real impact on the way that policies are implemented.
Well, it's weird to me because the president had talked about, protecting people who are from the LGBTQ community during the campaign.
Right.
He actually said that on during his acceptance speech for the Republican nomination. What I suspect is this is, we're in the middle of the midterms. This is a way, once again, to rile up the base of the Republican Party to get them to come out. You know, they're searching in many ways for items to show the Republican base that Donald Trump is, in fact, a social conservative or movement conservative as much as he is a nationalist conservative, as he has now defined himself as. So I think this fits into that. Brandon, what the news, we've talked about the midterms, but one of the elements that the president is saying this race is about, these midterms about, it's not just about Kavanaugh, it's about the caravan.
Right.
The president of the United States is saying that a caravan of individuals from Central America fleeing violence and searching for economic freedom are coming to the United States, and they are coming to get you, Brandon Rottinghouse.
Right.
Just you.
Right, no. And the president also implied that mixing in with this migrant group are criminals and, quote, unknown Middle Easterners. So
indeed, you got to watch out for those unknown Middle Easterners.
I don't know. It's not even a conspiracy theory from like the 1990s. It's like from the 1590s, right? The sort of, gypsies sort of out to get you.
It's That's like a great a, analogy. That's
like
exactly
some,
what
Yeah,
it
it's
is.
Like something used to scare kids in Halloween, right? The facts, I think, as you say, are definitely politically relevant, right? You've got about 2,000 migrants who are in this sort of mass caravan who are migrating their way, they say, to the U.S. This is an easy dog whistle for Republicans to use to try to gin up the support for their votes in the midterm. And I don't know if it'll have a dramatic effect, because I think a lot of this is already baked in. But if there were worries that Republicans weren't going to come out to vote because there wasn't like as much enthusiasm, especially in comparison to Democrats, then I think this is the one issue that might make it happen. My favorite Trump line, though, Jay, I'm going to say this, of all time has occurred in the context of this. Now, here's what the president said. After admitting to the reporters who were visiting with him in the Oval Office that there was no evidence to support the claim that this was happening, he said the following, quote, "There's no proof of anything, but there could very well be." So I'm going to use that in my next paper
abstract. That sums
up
the Trump presidency, doesn't it, pretty much? Right. We don't really know, but there could be.
There's no proof, but there could be, right?
Yeah.
Well, Pence said, look, it would be like, you know, it would be inconceivable if there weren't some people of Middle Eastern descent in the crowd. Again, it's a lot of dog whistle stuff, and so it's hard to know sort of fact from fiction here. But these kinds of humanitarian crises do, I think, clearly rise to the level of the political discourse that needs to be at the point where we deal with it. So we'll see. But politically, clearly, it's the case that this is going to be something that is riling up Republicans.
Well, look, there's a couple of things here. And I agree with you on the politics of it. I mean, this is designed entirely to gin up the base, not probably in many ways, unlike the transgender regulations. My sense of it is this, is that you've always had a situation almost on an annual basis where you've had mass sort of collected migration from Central America. We know that's been happening. Historically, what has happened is individuals have come to actual border crossings and then filed for asylum.
Yeah,
that's essentially what will happen now. They're not going to be invading or coming across the border. They're about 1,200 miles away, and there's fewer than 5,000 of them. Many of them are women and children. So this notion that there's sort of an invading army, I think that kind of rhetoric, hugely problematic.
Yeah.
But to me, the larger question is just the defining of this. This reminds me so much of when, in 2014, the critical issue in that midterm election was whether or not the president of the United States, in that case, Barack Obama, was going to be dealing with the pending Ebola crisis.
Right.
You remember that?
Did you get Ebola? I forget.
Yes. There was like five Ebola cases in the country,
right?
One of them happened to be in Dallas.
Right.
But the thing that got me about it was, and I was thinking back on it, is these are manufactured crises to essentially sort of, as we say, gin up for political purposes.
Yeah.
This works perfectly for the Republican base. They want to talk about this. But the Democrats, they just want to talk about health care and all these other things and Trump.
Yeah.
They want to talk about Trump to roll up their base. And we saw this play itself out, Brandon, at the Trump rally that we just had here in where we are in Houston, Texas. They had to move the rally from a smaller arena to a bigger arena.
Right.
The Toyota Center, 18,000 people. You had a giant kind of Texas tailgate going on. They had a live band, kind of a festive atmosphere.
It was, yeah.
And the president just went to crazy town in his speech.
There was a lot of like chest thumping rhetoric, right? I recall that the biggest amount of applause was the build the wall stuff, which is still, I think, the tagline for many people who supported the president, which is surprising even in Texas where the wall is fairly controversial. But he did, as you say, a lot of things to be able to try to knock down the Democrats' enthusiasm, including calling Beto O'Rourke a stone cold phony. So I don't know exactly if that's as sharp a criticism as he's had of others in the past, but it has certainly been directed at O'Rourke and Democrats who might want to back him. He also changed Ted Cruz's nickname. Jay, what's the new nickname?
Beautiful Ted.
Beautiful Ted.
Here's my point on this. This is why you know this is absurd. I don't think Heidi Cruz would call Ted Cruz Beautiful Ted.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure his mother would call him Beautiful Ted.
What's the opposite of lying Ted? Truthful Ted? Why not Truthful Ted, right?
You can't, because that might be lying there, Brandon.
But I think that the nature of the event did good for Cruz. I mean, it's really stimulating votes in Harris County, and this is the last big purple county. And if Republicans can hold the line here, then Cruz can do well. The president also suggested that he was going to put on the agenda a major tax cut for middle-income people. It's not apparently the case that this has been planned well, and that some of the members of Congress are looking at this with a little bit of a puzzled look. So though I think that the overall effect was good for Cruz, I don't know that the effect was so good for some of the down-ballot Republicans who are not maybe dealing with an electorate, especially a Republican electorate that's so enamored with Trump, especially maybe Culberson, right? Even maybe countywide with Ed Emmett. So it's going to be a counter rally to sort of counteract when the Democrats look at this too.
Yeah, there's probably two things that sort of struck me. One was the fact that, as you said, John Culberson wasn't there.
Yeah, he didn't even come.
And nor was County Judge Ed Emmett.
Yeah.
You did have Governor Abbott there. So that certainly, I think, added some gravitas to it. Personally, for me, I was offended that the President of the United States went out there and continued to lie to people that Houstonians and Harvey were essentially riding out on boats looking at high floodwaters to impress their wives and girlfriends. And this is a quote from him.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what he said. And it's offensive to a lot of the folks who live here and dealt with a horrific storm.
Yeah.
But the politics of it are just what it is. He's trying to rile up the base. I think he was successful in doing that. I'm not sure if it moved anybody one way or the other.
Yeah.
But for Cruz, he really wants to increase enthusiasm. I think it's notable that in an hour and a half speech, he mentioned the name Ted Cruz seven times, which isn't a whole lot.
Right, that's right. Hey, let's stay regional here and talk about what is happening at Prairie View A&M. Now, this is a really interesting case. So several students at the university are suing county officials for not providing enough early voting locations on campus, implying that they are discriminating against students on the basis of race and age. What do you think is the possible result of this, and what does it say largely about sort of voting in Texas?
Well, the county that they're in, Waller County, has had a long history of sort of an antagonistic relationship with Prairie View A&M. The county itself is actually very conservative, and Prairie View A&M is kind of this large African-American island in an otherwise predominantly Anglo county, and much more conservative county. And you've seen this sort of push back and forth really on a whole variety of issues, everything from sort of criminal justice related issues to voting. I think the issues are that the way our elections are governed in Texas are county by county, and the rules can differ greatly county by county. Locations, hours. Harris County, for example, is the only major county in Texas that has restricted hours for early vote, 8:30 to 4:30, inexplicably.
Yeah, it's an odd way to
stop. It's
very
odd.
Your
voting. But sort of after work starts and before work ends. I'm not sure what they're trying to say there. Every other county was running 7 to 7 at the same time. All those other large major counties, coincidentally, are controlled by Democrats. And this county is controlled by Republicans, Harris County. I'm not sure what they're trying
That's
to say there. So the county election process itself is dominated by political partisanship. And we need to recognize that. So that, to me, is what's coming here. The courts are ultimately going to kind of make a determination. But people want to vote this election, and we're going to talk about it more in the midterms when we get to it, whether there's restrictions or not, or enough voting locations or not. We are seeing something pretty remarkable here this cycle.
Yeah, I think how we vote will be the civil rights issue of the next decade. And the racial implications to where we put polling centers, I think, are not well known. And that's something that I think academic study needs to do. There was one study that I found that suggests that African Americans are less likely to vote in early voting, in part because of this placement of the voting location. So this is something which is definitely changeable. And I like the interesting sort of political dynamic that you mentioned. There's something to that. And like I said, this is something which is not going to go away. It's going to be a continuing problem, not only in Texas, but also across the rest of the country. Well, another issue facing Texas is that, and especially Austin, is that there has been so much rain in the region that there has been a swell in the Colorado River, and it's created a tremendous amount of moving, like mud and silt, and that's bad for water quality. So Austin is under a boil water notice. What's going on, Jay? What do you think the implications are?
Well, there's sort of two things here. One, obviously, you know, we've got climate change. We've got conditions that aren't, I mean, it wasn't that long ago where Austin was dealing with droughts perennially. I mean, and now we're dealing with sort of systemic flood problems. Climate change is happening, and governments need to be flexible. But there's a larger issue with the city of Austin in that they are a large, growing, expanding city, yet their infrastructure has just simply not kept up with it. And you see it not just with their water, wastewater system, but the roads. If anyone out there has ever driven in Austin, Texas, they know that it's...
You mean set in traffic in Austin, Texas.
Yeah, I-35 is basically a parking lot, right? And so these are the kind of things that they need to invest in, and they're just simply not.
Yeah, that's right. Well, another issue about investment is on the child welfare system. This is an ongoing fight, Jay, between the courts and Texas. A divided federal appeals court has confirmed that there are big flaws in the system. Now, the judge in this, the holding in this, suggests that the Texas is still able to and should reduce caseloads for overburdened workers, but there are also limits, and they struck down a ban on placing foster youth in large group homes. In terms of the implications, what do you take from this? I mean, what's your sort of sense of, in terms of investment, whether or not and how this might be solved?
Well, I mean, and look, we've talked about this before. The fundamental systems in Texas state government just aren't functioning correctly. And one of the things that has bothered me more than anything is just that we don't seem to care enough to want to make those investments and hold our elected officials accountable. The governor of Texas is in charge of the child welfare system, Child Protective Services, the Texas Education Agency, goes on and on. We've had systemic problems in all of them. And we don't seem to want to focus on making government work anymore.
Yeah. The judge in this, actually echoing your point, said that the state is deliberately indifferent to the risk posed by its policies and practices towards caseload management. So there's been, I think, enough blame to go around. But the problem is that the judicial cover here gives the legislature a little bit of wiggle room, right? That's not this case that they've said you have to do this and not that. They've said effectively that you can sort of make changes, and if you do, it'll maybe be okay. So this has been, I think, difficult to be able to figure out and will be a major issue in the upcoming legislative session.
Brandon, Democratic Attorney General candidate Justin Nelson has been building his entire campaign around the simple fact that Ken Paxton, our sitting attorney general, is indicted, criminally indicted right now. He got in a little bit of hot water with it, though. What happened?
Yeah, so he apparently had a giant mobile billboard he calls the Mugshot Mobile in the DoubleTree Motel across the street from a state building where much of the AG staff works. Now, Jay, you'd like to not, as an adult, be kicked out of the DoubleTree Hotel parking lot like a teenager, but I think the political upside for Nelson's pretty big, right? He wants to make this case. I mean, that is the one thing I think the polling shows that really dig into Paxton's margin. So I think that this highlights that vulnerability. Is he going to win? We spent a lot of time in a previous podcast talking about this. I think it'll be close. It'll be a race to watch, but I don't think you're going to see even like the O'Rourke Cruz margin.
Well, let's talk about that, Brandon. Let's shift gears a little bit. Talk about the big, sort of the big news of the week.
Bigger than big.
Bigger
early
than
voting.
Big. I know. Early vote, midterm elections.
Wow.
I think the best way to describe the growth is unprecedented. The voting so far, explosive. You know,
explosive.
What does this mean? Explosive. You like that?
I like that.
I know.
That's good.
What does this mean? I mean, what's your take on it? Do you feel like does it tell us anything that we're on pace to vote like we are in a presidential cycle and not a normal midterm? I'm not sure either of us thought it. I think we both had talked previously. We thought it was going to be a good turnout. I don't think any of us thought it was going to be presidential level.
And you're exactly right. And if it is presidential level, that means that you're talking about a swell of voters that almost never vote in midterms. So according to some of these numbers, you know, the Democrats are slightly lagging in terms of base turnout, but upwards of like 70% of voters are base voters. So 35% of early voters are Republican primary history voters. 32% are Democratic primary voter history. So that's about 70% total base vote. But there's about 7% who have no prior history. So that's something that maybe suggests a growth. But there's also 23% of people who have voted in elections in presidential, but not in midterm. So it's that 23% that's really the question mark, right? Are they voting for O'Rourke because they like the, you know, cut of his jib? Are they voting for Cruz because they're reinvested in the partisan politics and Trump has made that happen? I don't know. Maybe nobody knows, but that's the question.
Well, I mean, so let's unpack those numbers just a little bit. I mean, when we talk about the fact of the 3-point differential, in at least so far in terms of partisan differential, that is significantly better than we've seen in any midterm in the last 15 years.
Absolutely.
For Democrats. And so at the very least, while we can't say that, you know, we talk about the Democratic blue wave and whether it's going to crash on the red wall of Texas, what we do know is that the upsurge or the surge for voters for Democrats here is essentially kind of creating an effect where it's making the state more competitive. Mm-hmm. And I think for Democrats, they should not lose heart if they lose lots and lots of statewide races. Yeah. In large part because my sense is the margins are dramatically closing. So that while 2018 may not show this as a legitimately, you know, being able to sort of cross the line, we're entering, and we talked about this before, into a two-party state.
Yeah.
And this might be that first time. So when you start to see races under 10 points, under 8 points, sort of consistently the generic Democrat is within 7 or 8,
yeah,
that is a massive shift. 2 years ago, Wendy Davis lost by 21 points to Greg Abbott. No one even got within 10 points two years ago, or 4 years ago, rather.
His turnout was abysmal, like 28% then, so it was just awful. Now this is completely almost the opposite. A couple more bright notes for Democrats. You see a spike in four-time Democratic voters in suburban counties. So Collin County is a good example. 48% of Democrats who vote in the last four primaries have voted versus 40% of Republicans who voted in the last four Republican primaries. So that, Denton County, Fort Bend County, Williamson County, there's a spike in Democratic base votes. So that could be along the lines of what you're saying. There's also a spike in terms of border votes. Cameron County, El Paso, Hidalgo County all have a increase or about 9 to 10% of voters who have no previous general or primary history. So there's been a swell there. The likelihood is that the folks in those counties are voting Democrat. So there's a couple of bright notes, right, in terms of the statewide. Now, the implications down ballot could be even more profound, right? These areas connected districts where Democrats are competitive.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we talked about the surge in individual counties. El Paso County, already over 2 days, has already voted more than it voted the entirety of the early vote period.
Yeah.
We talked about
Is that O'Rourke, do you think?
I would assume.
Hometown?
Yeah, I would assume that's a little bit of the hometown. But we're seeing this in every county. Collin County, which is not an urban county, is seeing record-setting numbers. Tarrant County as well is seeing record-setting numbers, over 200%. From 2014. Dallas is at 300% of what they normally vote in midterms. So we're seeing it across the state. We're on pace to basically be vote similarly to what we did in 2016, which was the historical high water mark.
Yeah.
We know that there's a sort of a larger trend towards early voting anyway, that we're front-loading more votes. And this is my question. Does this carry over to Election Day, or are we just decided we're going to vote it all out now and just have a dud of an E-Day? Or is that going to carry over to E-Day, and we're looking at probably something unprecedented?
Yeah, I think that's good. You know, we see changing demographics in the state. We see more younger people voting early. That's been a change. You also see more females voting. The difference in gender was pretty big, too. You've got 51% who were female, and you've got 45% who were male. So there are some changes here, I think, in terms of how we vote. But you're right, E-Day could be a bit of a dud. But look, a lot can happen in the next couple of weeks. And a spike in turnout for Democrats on E-Day, which generally happens, could mean the difference of margin in many of these competitive races.
All right, so Brandon, I'm going to let you ask you, what do you think is going to happen on E-Day? We've seen week one of early vote. We've got, I guess, another week or close to another 5-6 days left. What's going to happen in these next 5 or 6? What's going to happen on E-Day?
I think it's going to be presidential level numbers, maybe not quite that high because there are differences in terms of counties, but I do think we're going to see big turnout, and that big turnout, I think, benefits Democrats.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, one number to me that jumped out, back in 2014, only about 7% of voters were between 18 and 35. This time it's approaching 15.5%.
Yeah.
That to me is nothing more than Beto O'Rourke. You're obviously seeing unprecedented interest, and it's making a difference.
Yeah. Persuasion's one thing, motivation and mobilization's another. So we'll see if the Democrats are good at that, if O'Rourke has helped.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer and frequent early voter, Ernie Manus. Special kudos to our web and graphics team at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, beautiful Todd Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.